Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in one of the wealthier counties in the state, and yet nearly 15% of Mecklenburg County households are considered food insecure. That means they have a reduced quality and variety of food to eat. In fact, they may be eating less because of a lack of money or because they live in a food desert where access to a grocery store requires traveling long distances, a challenge to those without adequate transportation. Inflation and the pandemic have both had an impact on an already difficult situation, but solutions are being worked on. One comes from the nonprofit Carolina Farm Trust, which is scheduled to open phase one of its new market this spring, located in Northwest Charlotte. The hope is that it will bring both healthy foods and jobs to what is considered a food desert. Zach Wyatt is president and CEO of the Carolina Farm Trust. He's here, along with Dr. Annie Hardison Moody, associate professor and extension specialist at NC State University, and Anthony Trotman, deputy Mecklenburg County Manager, responsible for the county's Health and Human Services Agency, including social services, public health, and community resources. Good morning. Welcome to you all. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Anthony, I'm going to start with you. Lean in. We're having trouble communicating with Anthony. He's having trouble hearing us this morning, so we'll just keep our fingers crossed. But I'm starting with you. We talked about food deserts and food insecurity on this program several times in the past over the years, and every time we do, the number of people living in these areas and in these conditions seems to grow. Is that still the case? Are the numbers continuing to rise? Or have efforts being made by the county or other government and non-governmental organizations starting to bear fruit?
Well, you started off stating that it was 15%, but our data shows it's 9%.
Okay.
So it's actually going down. And I think programs or initiatives like Zach's initiative with Carolina Farm Trust, as well as our home delivered meal program, as well as our SNAP program and SNAP double bucks programs are really working in our community.
So 9% is the figure, not 15. That means the number has gone down in Mecklenburg County. How does that translate, though, into numbers of people? What is 9%? What does that mean, 9%?
That's approximately 100,000 households. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the issue does not still persist.
Right.
You know, we've had a record number of individuals apply for SNAP benefits over time. And, you know, what we hear from Nourish Up is that there's a number of individuals that are also attempting to access our food pantries. So we know that, you know, there's an issue, but which is why it's a priority for our Board of Commissioners to continue to invest in programs in our community, such as, again, the work that Zach White is doing with Carolina Farm Trust.
So, Annie, can I call you Annie, Doctor?
That's perfectly fine.
Okay. Food deserts are places, as I said, where access to healthy food is difficult, if not impossible, and requires transportation, adequate transportation to get to grocery stores where you can buy healthy food. And that's difficult for a lot of people. How would you, though, define food insecurity? That's a different topic.
So food insecurity is defined by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as when a household isn't able to acquire, they don't have the amount of food that they need during a year to meet the needs of all family members. So that's the kind of definition of food insecurity. And we have different ways of measuring that in terms of looking at, did families have to go without to meet food needs in the family? Were they able to get the foods they needed? Were they able to afford the foods they needed? Did they give up certain things in order to be able to pay for food? But in general, that's kind of the definition of food insecurity as defined by the USDA.
And these two things, food insecurity and food deserts, are not necessarily connected. I suppose they could be, but they're kind of separate because food deserts are long-term. It's a long-term issue because you have to coax grocery stores into these areas, and that's proven difficult in some places. But people can fall in and out of food security depending on their financial situation. Is that correct?
That's right. Food insecurity can be, for many people, cyclical. So, for example, people who experience a health crisis in their family, where they're paying medical bills, and so other things they're not able to pay because they're paying for expensive medical care. It might be caused by unemployment or underemployment. Let's say several of the families that I've worked with over the last decade, for example, when hours get cut with a parent in the household. So they might fall into a period of food insecurity because of that. Some families, though, do remain persistently food insecure or experience very low food insecurity. But for many people, it is kind of cyclical, and people might move in and out of periods of food insecurity over the course of the family lifespan.
Anthony, do we have a number on that? How many people in Mecklenburg County may experience food insecurity at any given moment in time?
We don't track, numbers in that way. I think, as you started off stating that 15% of households were food insecure, and I stated that the number that we have based on our Feeding America data was 9%. And so it really depends. We believe that with the number of individuals that access the SNAP benefit and our food pantries, they do have access to food and fresh food. But we definitely know because of food deserts, there's an issue with access and transportation, which is why it's important that we deliver food in the various communities that need it.
There are people who have been impacted severely by inflation, and yet they still go to the grocery store and they buy things, and everybody eats. So it's sometimes difficult for people who take grocery stores and the ready availability of those grocery stores for granted to understand that there are places in our city and all over the country where they live in food deserts, where access to those stores is simply not available. But Annie, everybody has to eat. So why has it been so difficult to lure retailers who sell groceries into those areas that are short of grocery stores? They would essentially have a monopoly. Why is it difficult?
Well, I think there are a lot of complicated things that go into why grocery stores are not going into certain areas. Where kind of my experience is with the families and those experiences that they have who are living within areas that have limited access. And so what a lot of them are doing are shopping in other places. A lot of families that we've worked with over the years shop once a month. And they're doing a big shop generally when that coincides around the time when they receive their SNAP benefits. And so they're traveling, they might travel distances because there's not a grocery store within their community. But it's not only that particular access piece that's critical in how people are determining where they're shopping for food, particularly people with a limited income. So they're also looking at things like price and which grocery stores have the best prices. So they might travel. We've talked with lots of people who are traveling further to be able to get in their one big shop lower priced goods. They're also thinking about things like culturally and traditionally important foods. So people might be traveling to different grocery stores that are able to carry or that carry the foods that they had in their home countries, for example. And they're also thinking about the kinds of the transportation and availability that they have to get to those places, right? So if you're trying to take a bus somewhere and doing one big shop, what's convenient? Are you having to take multiple bus routes to get to a particular place? And so grocery stores, I think, are making decisions based on finances and based on the other things, and this and families are making decisions based on finances as well. But we, when we think about this as an equity issue, what are those are some of the core issues that families are facing as they're dealing with the lack of grocery stores, the lack of food access in their communities.
We're going to talk with Zach Wyatt with Carolina Farm Trust in a second about his efforts in one area that is considered to be a food desert. How many, though, Anthony, how many areas of town are considered to be food deserts?
Well, I think food deserts track along with our priority health neighborhoods, which are particularly what we call here, as you know, the Crescent, which is mainly on the west side. And parts of the east side. You know, as stated, these food deserts are, you know, really clusters of areas of 500 or more that, you know, are less than a mile away from a grocery store to gain access to fresh fruit and vegetables and produce. So there is an issue, and, you know, as Annie talked about, there has been difficulty in connecting with certain grocery stores, which is why it's so important that the county continue to invest in efforts to bring produce and fresh food and vegetables to the community. Again, and I've said it a couple of times, which is, you know, our investment with Carolina Farm Trust, our investment in the Three Sisters Market, our investment in mobile markets, our investment in corner store efforts, to have refrigeration in order to store fresh food. All the efforts that we have been deploying here at the county, we believe is extremely important. We still need grocery stores and we still need to continue to invest, which is why we continue to do so.
So these food deserts are not completely, food is not completely absent. I mean, usually you'll find fast food restaurants in it. You'll find these convenience markets, which have a lot of junk food in them, but no fresh produce to speak of, and probably not a lot of meats that you would cook on your own stove. Zach, this is where you kind of have been working to fill the gap for several years now. But before we talk about what you've been doing, talk about what the Carolina Farm Trust is and what it's all about.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I mean, Carolina Farm Trust really is, I mean, the vision is really building what regional resilience and using food and agriculture is kind of the primary driver. I don't think many people realize that food and agriculture run the world. It has everything to do with our health and nutrition. It has everything to do with upward mobility and equity, sustainability and climate change. And we have to kind of go back and kind of rebuild that infrastructure. So we're working on urban farms to bring people back to where our food comes from and why that's important. Workforce development to get career tracks back into agriculture. How do we link, you know, food and health together and create systems to meet community where they are? And then how do we create distribution channels to make sure our farmers, our regional farmers, have profitable revenue streams? And to the point that we've been discussing so far, how do we create supply chains for every single person up and down the socioeconomic ladder to participate in, and then also for major institutions as well? The key factor in everything, you know, that Annie and Anthony were talking about, it's scale. I mean, it's very expensive to try to meet these needs in these small ways. We got to figure out how to do it at scale, and so that's what we've been working on.
We're going to come back and talk more about some of the other things that the Carolina Farm Trust is involved in, but also about this project that hopefully is opening momentarily in one area of town to deal with this particular food desert. Zach Wyatt is here from the Carolina Farm Trust, Dr. Andy Hardison-Moody from NC State University, and Anthony Trotman from Mecklenburg County. We're going to come right back and talk more about this in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about food deserts and food insecurity and solutions to both of those semi-connected problems with Dr. Andy Hardison Moody, an associate professor and extension specialist at NC State University. Anthony Trotman is the Mecklenburg County deputy manager who oversees Consolidated Health and Human Services, and Zach Wyatt is the president and CEO of the Carolina Farm Trust. I was trying to remember, Zach, yesterday, and you've been on this program several times, when the first time that you came on, I can't remember what year that was, but it was several years ago.
2018.
Okay. and you were working to acquire farmland to set up so-called urban farms. What kind of progress have you made?
A lot. I mean, the hard part with land, I mean, we have about 36 acres under management right now. We have 6 acres over in East Charlotte with a partnership with the urban farm, I mean, the at the Aldersgate Retirement Community. Mariah Henry is our director of urban farming, and she's doing an amazing job of getting that project to its potential. We have 28 acres right on the line of the city of Charlotte and Huntersville, right behind Northlake Mall, with a private individual. And, you know, we just planted 200 blueberry bushes. You know, we're working on getting some potatoes in the ground. And so it's been hard because of how much money it costs to get all of this up and running. The infrastructure costs are just insane. You know, power, water, sheds, equipment, tractors, you know, so it's extensive, you know, but Trane Technologies has really come through with us and helping us build that model out. So it's really starting to come along a lot. It's just taken a lot longer than what I've liked, but we're really starting to see kind of the fruits of the labor.
I don't think urban farms need to be defined. I think it's in the title. These are farms that are in urban areas, but I'm curious how they differ from community gardens, neighborhood gardens, because the word farm is in there. That indicates something bigger.
Yeah, and I think that's really the only kind of vision of it. I mean, community gardens are amazing. They also have a lot of challenges. You know, typically it's on the burden of like one person to kind of keep that going, and burnout is very real. And so, you know, on the urban farming side, it is really trying to treat it as a business. Even though we're a nonprofit, you know, that doesn't mean we can't make money. We want to make a lot of money in the adventures that we're going after. We're just reinvesting those profit margins right back into our mission. So it's really scale. I mean, community gardens, you know, typically are for a very small pocket wherever they're located. And these farms, like for the 20 acres in Huntersville, for example, Mike, I mean, we're trying to build a true homestead out there so people can kind of understand how hard farming is, why it's important. I mean, the county's been investing a lot of money in trying to look at farm preservation in Mecklenburg County. But how are the residents supposed to even understand why it's important if they don't even know what it is? You know, so it's just really critical that our urban citizens understand what our rural citizens are going through. And, you know, back to the point of just food deserts in general, I mean, we've given our entire need of survival away to a handful of conglomerates. And how do we bring that back? But it has to be an experience. I mean, people aren't going to make a behavior change, you know, listening to the radio or a conference or a white paper. They got to feel it. And that's one thing that I've been, you know, what was really shocked me, just bringing our corporate partners and other people down, is that engagement and that curiosity. And it really doesn't matter if you have a connection to farming or not. There's just something about it that just brings something with all of us that wants to know more. And it's just that perfect stage to get intergenerational, you know, engagement with it. And so we're very bullish on it, and we're excited to see it growing.
You kind of said it just a moment ago, but I read something that you said to another interviewer yesterday, and you, in which you said about 90 years ago, most of us completely divorced ourselves from our entire means of survival. That's a pretty shocking thing. When you think about food, we have to eat or we don't exist. And we don't know where our food comes from or how it is produced. You buy a steak in plastic in the grocery store. You buy an ear of corn in a bin in the grocery store. Many people have never visited a farm. They have no idea what it takes. You've got farmers who are growing all this material for us, who are aging out and are facing financial difficulties, partly because farming has always been difficult, as you point out, but also because they're working for a big ConAgra, to name one company, organizations. and fewer young people want to go into the business. Is one of your hopes that by exposing people to what it takes to grow the food that we have to eat, no matter where you live, that people will be more interested in how we grow it and maybe even go into growing it themselves? Is that your hope?
Well, I mean, it's a reality and a hope. I mean, there's a lot of people that want to get into farming. The barrier is just insane. Unless you have a couple $1 million to buy the land, buy all that equipment, you know, cultivate. I mean, you know, it takes a couple years to get your soil the way you need it to for good production. There's so much regulation in place as you kind of grow. You know, so, I mean, I get emails all the time of people wanting to get into it. It's just a matter of how. You know, so again, if there's money in it, that's the key. So that's kind of where our distribution platform and that scalability is so important. You know, my team has been going around the state over the last 6 to 8 weeks. I think our roster is up about 53 farms right now. You know, we're working with some major institutions. We're working with the county. We're working with different clinics. We're working with Heal Charlotte is another nonprofit in off of Sugar Creek 8-5 doing great work. We're trying to put a CFT market on the ground floor to serve those residents. So we're really working on building infrastructure to get revenue into our farmers, guaranteed revenue, you know, and then get it out to our community partners and our institutions so we can meet that scale, drive prices down a little bit to create it on volume. But the infrastructure, Mike, is the key factor here, and we have to make it easy. I mean, I got to make it easy for the institutions to work with us. I got to make it easy for the county to work with us, other organizations, and the average consumer. It's got to be as easy as walking down the street to the bodega and the corner store.
And we're going to come back to one of the efforts that you're about to open on the west side of town that may help all of that, plus alleviate a food desert, or at least add some fresh food into a food desert. Anthony, some experts say that not having access to healthy food is a public health issue and one that impedes upward mobility. So it's also a long-term economic issue, if that's true. Is that something that is recognized by public officials, by either at the county or the city or the state level?
It is. And we believe it is. Well, it is one of the social determinants of health. Without healthy food and nutrition, specifically for expectant mothers, is difficult to have, you know, a healthy birth, which creates a whole host of issues for our overall system. But it's also an issue for our seniors as well as our students, which is why, you know, one of the programs that we are excited about is a federal program, which is our summer EBT program, which is called Sunbucks. And so, as you know, kids, you know, have access to food during the school year, and in the summertime, they do not. With the new program called Sunbucks, they will have access to fresh food and vegetables throughout the summer. And we were very excited about that program. But it is an overall social
I think you've frozen. We've lost.
There we go. Obviously, economic development and growth.
Okay. Annie, you wanted to chime in here.
I did. You know, working kind of in the public health arena as I do, it absolutely is one of our public health priorities. It's a part of Healthy People 2030, outlines this related to food access as and how it connects to food security. And that's one of the Healthy People 2030 targets that as a nation we are not meeting. We are doing worse. We were doing a bit better during the pandemic, surprisingly so, because of the resources that people had to additional funding through the stimulus funding, through PEBT, and through enhanced SNAP benefits that people had. We saw a decrease actually after 2020, we saw a pretty sharp rise in food insecurity in 2020. And then we saw a decrease as that kind of support funneled into families. So as Anthony's talking about, this is so critical. And I've heard over the last decade how important things are like this to moms and to families who are struggling, particularly during those summer months where it's really difficult We heard a lot of this during interviews during the pandemic. When children are home, there are more mouths to feed, right? When they're not having free meals at school or reduced price meals at school, there are more mouths to feed at home. And as a mom of young children, I can say, I mean, we just ran through snacks this weekend because there are people in and out of the house. And the other important thing when we look at programs like this in terms of things like one of the Healthy People 2030 recommendations is to promote healthy school meals for all. Because when we look at systemic reviews of what works related to particularly children and food insecurity, that not only do kind of these more universal programs like the Sunbucks program or like more universal school meal programs, they get more people enrolled and receiving services, but we also see reductions in things like absenteeism, and we see better school outcomes for our kids. So this is really important, and it does tie back to those national priorities that we have in public health related to food access and food and how it shapes.
Clearly, food is essential, and we know that kids who don't eat properly can't study because they can't concentrate because they're hungry all the time. There's also a domino effect. You're the expert in this, Dr. Hardison Moody, because this is one of your areas of expertise. You've studied this. There's this domino effect that occurs when people don't have access to quality, nutritious food, and you say that it affects the nuclear family. Talk about that. How so?
So one of the things that we have found in our research, and this is other researchers have found this as well, is that mothers in particular parents try to buffer their children from the experiences of food insecurity, and mothers in particular are doing this work. So we have done through a longitudinal study, it's called Voices into Action, co-led by me, Dr. Sarah Bowen, and Dr. Seneca Elliott. And we, along with a team of graduate students and other researchers, have spent years in families' homes, talking with mothers, talking with caregivers, and seen it firsthand. Mothers are feeding children first to ensure that they have enough food, and they're going without. They're doing things like utilizing caffeine, drinking coffee, or drinking carbonated like sodas during the day to try to stay full so that they're able to ensure that their children have enough food. They're doing things, Anthony mentioned earlier, utilizing emergency food services. Even when those experiences are not always, they don't always feel good. Mothers have talked to us about feelings of shame and stigma about seeking emergency food services, both because of they're feeling that there are other people who are worse off than they are. Also feelings that they don't want to be seeking these services. They don't want to have to utilize SNAP benefits. They want to be able to do this and provide for their families. And then the third thing that we found in that mothers have done is they'll receive foods from food pantries that are not, they're not foods that make sense for their families. They're not foods that are necessarily always healthy or the things that they want to feed their kids. And sometimes they've received foods that are rotten or they felt like are expired. And so the kind of indignities that moms and parents have faced in feeding their children are part of the emotional toll that I think that takes on the family in terms of trying to keep kids fed.
You received your PhD, I understand, in religion, and your studies have focused on the intersection of religion and public health and on gender, food insecurity, and poverty. How much of this is a religious or moral issue, the fact that we have scads of people out there who can't eat?
Right. And that's honestly the central thing that took me to do my PhD in religion and public health, of thinking about, I had worked in the Division of Public Health on physical activity and nutrition in particular, and worked on developing a program that's called Faithful Families, Thriving Communities. We developed that in public health as a partnership with Extension to kind of harness the power of religious communities in addressing health issues that they see in their communities. And yeah, that's why that's kind of some of the work that I do is both on the side of working with religious communities to help them think about what are the core issues that our community is facing, whether that's like our congregation, our synagogue, our masjid, that what are the experiences that we are facing internally, but also what does our neighborhood landscape look like? What is our broader community? How can we be a part of the bigger picture? So many of our food pantries are run by faith-based organizations. They're run on a shoestring. They're volunteer-led, they're volunteer funded. And so there's that piece of it. But on the side of the research that I do with mothers and caregivers related to food insecurity, one of the things that we're continuing to look at and to understand is how also people cope with some of these indignities and these very difficult experiences of poverty and food insecurity and the kinds of religious languages or practices that they utilize or think about in terms of their kind of coping. And so, for example, moms who have talked to us about the ways that their prayer life and their spiritual life is one of the things that gets them through in these hard times. So it's both sides. I'm like working with the organizations, but also analyzing the kind of religion.
It's kind of a three-legged stool. You have these faith-based organizations who run these food pantries on a volunteer basis, and sometimes the food is in plentiful supply, sometimes it's not, sometimes it's fresh, sometimes it's not. Then you have people like Zach who are trying to grow food, and we'll talk in the next segment about how he's trying to distribute that food into these food deserts. And then you have governmental organizations providing money and other access to food. Who should shoulder any? Who should shoulder the bulk of the responsibility?
I think that's a difficult question to answer. I think, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, with this being a moral issue, one of the things that we're hoping to do with this research is to enable people to the broader public to see the realities of what food insecurity looks like, to understand, as Zach was talking about earlier, these are systemic issues that shape our entire food system. And as Anthony's talked about as well, they also shape our public health system. So we've got to all be thinking about it, and we have to all, as individuals, communities, and organizations, be invested.
I know Zach wants to talk about this, and we will do that when we come back. And we'll also talk about one of the efforts that the Carolina Farm Trust has been involved in over the last several months and getting it ready to open now on in one area neighborhood to help with food insecurity and alleviate a food desert problem when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Zach Wyatt is here, President and CEO of the Carolina Farm Trust. Dr. Annie Hardison Moody, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist at NC State University, and Anthony Trotman, Mecklenburg County Deputy Manager, who's in charge of Health and Human Services and very many aspects of that. Zach, we were talking just before the break about who should shoulder the bulk of the responsibility for curing this problem or addressing this problem, whether it should be religious and faith-based organizations, nonprofits like yours, or government entities, and you wanted to chime in on that.
Yeah, I mean, the responsibility is really all of us. I mean, the psychological effect on all this, I couldn't agree with, kind of Annie more on that. Whether you're on EBT and SNAP or you're a farmer or, I mean, as a parent, I mean, how far are you willing to go to feed your child? I mean, I think everyone can answer that, and they're going to go pretty far. And it's not that we're not smart enough to figure out these solutions. We are. It's not that we don't have the money. We do. I mean, it's an active choice that we don't do it. And I also have a lot of empathy for all involved too. I mean, because we keep asking the government, we keep asking corporations and these major foundations to solve these solutions. And I think the nonprofit sector has to come to the table too. I mean, we need to be working more collaboratively. We need to really look at these system solutions and understand where we can all play. We need to create earned revenue models to keep these things going because we can't keep every time going back and asking for more and more and more because these needs are continuing to rise. But I mean, Mecklenburg County should be very proud of our BOCC and our county manager's office for the amount of money they've invested with the American Rescue Plan Act across the board, to grassroots and nonprofits to work on these system issues. So it takes a lot of us, but we have to bring solutions, you know, to the table that we can execute.
So let's talk about the solution you're bringing to the table. In 2022, it was announced that your organization was developing plans for what was then described as a bustling food market and distribution center with a rooftop garden, a test kitchen, a meat processing facility, and a grocery store off I-85 near Brookshire Boulevard. That's in the Crescent. That's one of those food deserts that we've been talking about. Yep. The building you are were planning to work with was 25,000 square feet plus a 60,000 square feet of garden green space. That was all announced in February of 2022. It was scheduled to be completed this year with the first phase opening this spring. Where do you stand?
We're almost there. We're just waiting for our friends over at Duke Power to get us permanent power, and then we can line up the inspections. But yeah, I mean, McFarland Construction has been working hard with us. And I mean, as anybody in construction understands how difficult permitting and everything else getting through that cycle, we are excited. Phase one, it will be coming online in a few weeks, if not sooner. Phase one of the project is our 3,000 square foot commercial kitchen. And then basically all of our wholesale operation, which will allow us to kind of get started. Phase two, we are currently fundraising on. So the phase one was primarily funded through Mecklenburg County, the City of Charlotte, and Congresswoman Madam's office. And we're looking to the private sector for our phase two funding, which does include a retail market. It will include our teaching kitchen, event space, and that meat processing and butchery component. We've already had a few funding meetings that look very promising. Phase two is already in permitting. So we're just waiting to get that. And as soon as we get the funding, we can hit go.
When it's all done, how do you envision this helping this community, which is in an area that the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Food Policy Council categorized as an area of high risk? How do you see it working?
So Michael Bowlings, who our general manager, we already have quite a few job posts out there, and we're doing, the community in Thomas Pearl Hoskins neighborhood has kind of the first right of refusal of just getting for the job applications. We will be doing pop-up markets, on location once we open. Our team just had a great meeting with Thomas Pearl Academy, which is a K-8 CMS school right down the street, on how we work with them over the summer with school programming. Like I said previously, we're going to put a small CFT market on the ground floor of Hewell Charlotte's Hotel on Sugar Creek and 85. We're looking at other infrastructure that already exists, to put many versions of bodegas out there that we will stock. We're working on trying to get a retail mobile grocery store, so we can serve communities, all day, every day. They can just come back, get restocked, and kind of go back out again. It's working with different organizations, Mike, and just figuring out what those needs are and then how we can best fill them.
You talked about phase one, having this commercial kitchen. What will it do either for you or for the community? How does that work? How do you plan to use it?
Correct. Again, earned revenue is a huge component of this project. So we will be doing caterings. We have a food truck called CFT Bistro. We are going to create our own value added product line, not only for us, but we can white label things for our farming community. But we can also process stuff. Foundations really love funding that end product. So, how do we make sure every school bus stop in a mile radius has breakfast sandwiches in the morning, for example? How do we take carrots and celery and get them into packages to daycares and other things that just need that minimal processing? So it'll be a full service commercial kitchen. We're going to develop our own culinary team, really creating career tracks for people coming out of Community Culinary School of Charlotte, for example, or Charlotte Rescue Mission. Or there's a big gap sometimes between when they graduate those programs and that next step. It's a very a wide range of things that we can do in the building.
And you've said that this Carolina Food Trust market will lead to more local food production And you said that this can make it easy for the community to actually participate in the local food economy, which is difficult for them to do now. How will they do that? How will this work?
Well, so I mean, like Anthony mentioned, the corner store issue with the county. The biggest issue with them getting that produce is typically with the main distributors, they have to hit certain minimums or else they're not going to deliver. Back to the responsibility, as a nonprofit, again, we want to work on earned revenue, but we also have obviously a lot of grants that we can apply for. So we need to kind of shoulder the burden where the burden is. We just leased our first big box truck that we're going to go pick up produce and proteins from our farming community and bring it to the facility. We got Sprinter vans, very close to getting funded so we can start making deliveries out to our community. So it's working with different shelters and different organizations on how do we make this stuff as easy as possible. We've been distributing stuff to Angels and Sparrows up in Huntersville. We've been doing little things with Nourish Up as it kind of comes up. But we can work on, once this infrastructure is really in place, how do we work across the board on that kind of distribution model to get the food where it needs to be? When it's needed.
So when this is all up and running and you're 100%, you say that people in the community will be able to go to this distribution center and purchase affordable, and the key word there is affordable, fruits and vegetables, meat and dairy products right from regional farmers. First of all, what does affordable mean and how do you make it so in the current economic environment?
Well, the EBT and SNAP match program the county has is going to play a huge role because right now that's a dollar for dollar match, which is a huge part of this. And that's kind of where, from our marketing efforts and getting people to engage with this, this is not a poor person's problem. This is a everybody problem. The reason why we need a regional food system is because we can't have something happening in Eastern Europe completely disrupt our entire food system, and we're all suffering from inflation. We should not have a tiered food system. We are literally giving the most vulnerable people the worst food literally on the planet. So we need Myers Park and Dilworth and South Park and Eastover and Wendover, all of them to participate in this is just as much as we want to support marginalized communities. So the earned revenue model that we'll really be able to do will help us allow to have kind of different price points on depending on where people are. And that's just going to be a work in progress. We're not going to try to turn people away. We need to ensure people understand the scope of what this problem is, and then how we're kind of delivering those solutions.
And you've said that although when this is up and running, this market is going to be for the neighborhood in which it exists, you also think it's important for everyone in Charlotte to visit the market. Why?
Well, we all have the need of survival, Mike. It was just announced yesterday, Wegmans is going to Ballantyne. Think about what Wegmans could do if they went to West Charlotte and built that in West Charlotte. Leave gentrification alone, but just the amount of what that could bring, to West Charlotte and these food insecure areas. One of the coolest things we've seen is when we're doing funding meetings, when we're having site visits, almost 99% of the time when we're bringing people to the facility is the first time they've ever been, to that neighborhood. Sometimes it's the first time they've ever went, to Freedom all the way there across 85 to it. So it opens up a lot of people's eyes with the city which they live in. We all are trapped in our natural kind of environment, and we forget about these, digital fences, that we kind of build up. So it brings a lot of enlightenment, on where we are truly as a city. Because if you go to Dilworth or Myers Park and we're 50 out of 50, well, I don't think we're 50 out of 50. But once you start going into the Crescent, now I understand why we're 50 out of 50. So it is imperative, to make this kind of self-interest. It impacts literally everyone. And until everyone kind of understands that, we're not going to be able to kind of meet that need. But again, we have to design systems where this is approachable. We can't, be running around like Chicken Little with the sky is falling. but the sky's falling a little bit, you know, and we had to kind of bring hope to all of this. And that's kind of the real key factor.
So, Anthony, is the Carolina Farm Trust's market just a piece of a larger puzzle, or is it a standalone project, one that you hope will act as a catalyst for other standalone projects? How do you see this working and ultimately helping?
Well, along with our investment in Carolina Farm Trust, we also invested in strengthening the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Food Policy Council, because, you know, we know that we need to make data-driven decisions, and that's what we looked to the Food Policy Council to do. We started off talking about the number of food insecure households and where those food insecure households are and how to get food to those food insecure households. We are looking to the Food Policy Council to help us solve some of these issues and in order to deploy solutions. So Carolina Farm Trust, I believe, is a major part of the solution. But, you know, we have invested in several initiatives throughout the community, both in social services and public health.
Anthony, 2 years ago, Mecklenburg County had given $3 million in COVID-19 relief money to this project, and the city was considering at the time about half that amount. Did that come to pass? Has more funding been designated for this project or similar projects aimed at ending food instability and diminishing food deserts?
Well, specifically for Carolina Farm Trust, the county, we've invested $6 million to support Carolina Farm Trust. And we have supported the organization to secure additional funding, such as the funding from Congresswoman Adams, and writing letters of support to our state delegation as well. So we definitely are very supportive of the work that Zach and his team are doing in our community.
Doctor, you mentioned earlier in this conversation that the pandemic resulted in extra money coming to people who desperately needed it to feed their families, and much of that money has gone away now because it was all COVID-19 relief money. But the pandemic highlighted a lot of things about our systems that are in place in a lot of different areas, among them food systems and the way we get food to people who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. What did it tell you? What did the pandemic expose about food insecurity?
I think that we saw, some of the things that we heard from caregivers as we talked to caregivers, not only in North Carolina, but across the US during the pandemic at three separate points. One is that programs and supports that are universal are the most beneficial at both promoting human dignity, but also at reducing the administrative burden that people feel in whether it's accessing emergency food services. So for example, during the pandemic, people could just go and pick up food boxes often at schools or at places that were easy to access. They didn't have to sign up. They didn't have to only come once a month. There was an ease of service and use that was really beneficial to people. And similarly with things like PEBT benefits, people being able to kind of automatically get those benefits. We released some of those administrative burdens. I know that Anthony, like you could talk about this for a long time. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Carolyn Bird, does a lot of work to try to get more people enrolled in SNAP programs. But it's a lot of administrative burden that people have to go through. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but when when it was easier for people to access services, more people got them, and we saw rates of childhood food insecurity and overall food insecurity decrease. It also helped people to feel, the mothers talked about how they felt, well, other people were receiving this too, and other people were getting, whether it was, you know, school meals that they were sent home or things like that. They didn't feel singled out for receiving services, which is what so many people feel when they're accessing emergency food or they're accessing SNAP benefits. They feel singled out. And so that is one of the lessons, I think, from the pandemic, that where we can promote human dignity and empower people, that is where we can do the most good.
And that's where we have to leave this conversation. I guess it's a decent place to leave it. Dr. Andy Hardison Moody, Associate Professor at NC State University and an Extension Specialist there. Anthony Trotman, Mecklenburg County Deputy Manager in charge of Consolidated Health and Human Services. And Zach Wyatt, President and CEO of Carolina Farm Trust. Their first phase of their Carolina Farm Trust market is scheduled to open in just weeks. Thank you for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.